Good evening, my friends, and welcome back to Hitchens on Horror. I am your host, Josh Hitchens, and this is the Hitchens on Horror Halloween special covering the Midnight Hour. Good evening, my friends. I hope everyone had a very, very safe and happy Halloween this year. Now, you may be confused as to why I'm releasing a Halloween episode on November 1st, and I'm doing so for several reasons. One is that I'm sure all of you, like me, have enjoyed the spooky month of October, reading scary stories, watching scary movies, going trick-or-treating, maybe visiting some haunted house attractions, and now the month of October is ended, and for some of us that can be a very, very sad time. But I am a firm believer that every day can be Halloween if you so choose. So I am creating this episode and releasing it on the day after Halloween for those of you who just aren't quite ready to let go of the Halloween spirit yet. Now, the other reason I am releasing this episode is that the movie that we are going to be watching together and talking about tonight actually premiered on Friday, November 1st, 1985 on ABC. This movie is called The Midnight Hour, and it is my favorite Halloween movie of all time. It is the one movie I have to watch every single year on Halloween, more than any other, more than Trick or Treat, more than John Carpenter's Halloween, more than Treehouse of Horror. The Midnight Hour is the one I have to watch. Now, this is a movie that I'm sure most of you listening to this podcast probably have never heard of, and you're not alone. The Midnight Hour is one of those movies that I feel has been sadly kind of lost to time. It is much beloved by those who grew up watching it, myself included, and I'll talk more about that in a bit. It was released on VHS in the 1980s, and in 1999/2000, it did receive a DVD release by Anchor Bay Entertainment, which is now long out of print. It's never been re-released on DVD, never been re-released on Blu-ray. It is not streaming officially on any platform. So it's hard to find this movie unless you know about it and know to look for it. But thankfully, The Midnight Hour is on YouTube in its entirety in a very pristine version, I assume cut from the DVD release from over 20 years ago. So you can watch it that way. And as I do the time breaks in this film, that is the version that I am using. However, there is a kind soul who has done a wonderful thing and has uploaded, also on YouTube, the original airing of The Midnight Hour on television with the original 1985 television commercials intact. So, if you so choose, you can watch this movie as it originally aired on Friday, November 1st, 1985. And that's how I originally watched it. I have to thank my mother for introducing me to The Midnight Hour when I was pretty young. I'd say maybe about 8 years old is the first time I saw this. And my mother had actually recorded this movie when it first aired on television. And she paused and edited out most of the commercials as she was recording it. So I didn't get to see all the fun 80s TV commercials in that recording. But that VHS copy that my mother made is one that I watched over and over again as a child, as a teenager, and growing up, got my own VHS and then DVD copy of it. I love this movie to pieces. It is perfect, perfect Halloween fare. And this is a movie that really honestly has everything you might want in a Halloween horror movie. One, it really gets the setting of Halloween right. You know, has a very autumnal feel set in the small town of Pitchford Cove in Massachusetts, also known sometimes as Pitchfork Cove, for reasons we will discover later. And this movie features, as many 80s horror movies does, a group of teenagers played by people who are definitely way, way past the age of teenagers. They decide to unleash a curse in a cemetery on Halloween night that causes all the demons of hell to be released. And they take over the town, kill everyone, and everyone who is touched by evil, according to the curse, will become evil. So this movie has, again, perfect quaint small town setting with a witchcraft trial past, a curse unleashed on Halloween night in a creepy, very, very, very creepy graveyard. And all the demons of hell that are released from this curse, you have a spectrum. You have vampires. You have a witch who is somehow also now a vampire, because why not? You have zombies. You have werewolves. So many spooky, spooky things, including a ghost who is a 50s teen girl who is looking for love. She's the good ghost of this film. And this movie also, God bless it, has a musical number called Get Dead, which is a ripoff of Michael Jackson's Thriller, which came out the year before this movie was made. And this movie actually features a lot of the same makeup personnel and the choreography team of the Thriller music video, which I think really explains why the makeup and creature designs in The Midnight Hour are truly stellar, especially for a made-for-TV movie of the mid-1980s. This movie also, I think, is incredibly violent and scary for the time it was made. You definitely wouldn't get away with something like The Midnight Hour on television nowadays, more's the pity. When I was watching this as a kid, there are a couple scenes in this movie that I literally would hide behind the living room sofa while those scenes were going on and sort of peek my head out at various times until the scenes were over. And I gotta be honest, those scenes that scared me as a child, I still find quite scary today. And that's one of the great things about The Midnight Hour, because it was marketed as kind of a horror comedy. Its tagline was, "Ghouls just want to have fun." But The Midnight Hour is one of the few horror comedies that I think actually truly successfully does both those things. It is fun. It is funny at times. There is a drunken zombie who's credited as the ghoul, who is really, really hilarious, really great, almost clown-like performance. So there's all that. But when this movie decides to be serious and scary, it is seriously scary. It does not hold back from the horror at all. And I have often said, and I'll say again several times throughout this episode, that The Midnight Hour is the only movie, for me anyway, that has werewolves that are actually truly frightening. I'm not talking about like a creepy transformation sequence. There are movies that have really excellent werewolf transformation sequences. Of course, An American Werewolf in London is one of those. The Company of Wolves is another. God, I love that movie. I'll be covering it eventually on this podcast again. But the werewolves in The Midnight Hour are just absolutely terrifying, to me anyway. So even though this is a movie that was made for television in 1985, it comes from the era when network television really took its television movies seriously, like spent a lot of money on them, hired good people to write and direct them, hired good actors to be in them. Not like A-list actors, of course, but like actors that had done stuff. And this movie is filled with a very stacked cast of actors that you're like, oh, I've seen that person in this or that. Some of the actors would go on to become much more famous than they were at the time they made The Midnight Hour. Some of the actors, this was kind of their swan song. But this is a great Halloween movie, extremely well made. And I'm very, very excited to watch it along with you, especially if you've never seen it before. This is my Halloween treat for all of you. So because this movie has, as I said, kind of been lost to time, there is not really a ton of documentation about the genesis of it, unlike other movies I talk about on this podcast. You know, there's really no information of why The Midnight Hour was made, what the process of making it was like, anything like that. None of the actors involved, at least that I've been able to find on the internet, have ever really mentioned it at all. But their careers really speak for themselves. I'm going to talk briefly about them. So the movie was written by, by William Blyke. I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly. He's credited as Bill Blyke in this film, but soon after The Midnight Hour, started being credited as William Blyke. And he wrote a lot of made-for-TV movies, a lot of thriller, a lot of horror, was nominated for an Edgar Award for his script for another horror TV movie that aired in 1985 called Deadly Messages, and also went on to write 10 episodes of Poltergeist The Legacy, that the TV series that was in no way related to the Poltergeist movies, but used the name. Really, I think, underrated paranormal TV show from the 90s. Poltergeist The Legacy is worth checking out if you've never seen it. And Deadly Messages that William Blyke wrote was also directed by the same guy who would go on to direct The Midnight Hour. And his name is Jack Bender. And he is probably the one whose career took off the most after the Midnight Hour came out. Jack Bender went on to direct Child's Play 3, but then didn't do a lot of feature film work, but then went into directing and producing for television, and went on to be a producer and director of three of the most acclaimed television series of recent times. He directed many episodes of Lost, and was nominated for several Emmy Awards for his direction of Lost. Also directed several episodes of David Chase's The Sopranos on HBO. And Jack Bender then continued his relationship with HBO, directing episodes of Carnival, series that was canceled way too soon, and also Game of Thrones, and was also nominated for an Emmy for his directing in Game of Thrones as well. Still a very, very active and influential television director and producer. Thank you, Jack Bender, for The Midnight Hour, and I'm glad that you've enjoyed a great career since then. Talking a little bit briefly about the score of The Midnight Hour, because the music in this movie is great as well. So the film score itself was done by a composer named Brad Fidel, who went on after The Midnight Hour to a pretty impressive career as a film composer. James Cameron hired him to do the film score for The Terminator and Terminator 2 Judgment Day and True Lies. Brad Fidel also had an extensive career doing scores for horror movies other than The Midnight Hour, including Fright Night, Fright Night Part 2, and several others. Does really delightful work here. The opening theme for the credits of The Midnight Hour perfectly sets the mood for the film and perfectly matches the images that are on film in the opening credits of it's this idyllic small town setting, you know, people very excited, getting ready for Halloween. But he also does the spooky, scary, chilling horror movie music extremely well. And the songs that are used in The Midnight Hour are all terrific. It's a very 50s dominated soundtrack. Just wonderful, wonderful songs included that perfectly fit and enhance the tone of the movie. And I have to wonder that perhaps because the songs used in The Midnight Hour are all very popular, very well-known recordings, I wonder if maybe that is part of the reason why it has not been re-released on DVD and Blu-ray and is not streaming on any services other than YouTube, of course, because of the music licensing issues, potentially. I don't know. I'm just speculating. But I can't understand why more people don't know that this movie exists. But now you will. So let's talk about the cast for The Midnight Hour. Our leading man in this movie is Lee Montgomery, who plays Phil Grenville, who is the kind of nerdy high school boy who's interested in history and the creepy folklore of his town. I always identified with him as a character growing up and just kind of have become him. Anyway, Lee Montgomery plays Phil. Grenville does an amazing job. And Lee Montgomery was no stranger to horror as well. He first started off as a child actor in the horror movie Ben, which was released in 1972, where he's a little boy who befriends a pack of killer rats. Wild, ridiculous movie worth your time. He is also in the cult classic Burnt Offerings, directed by Dan Curtis, the creator of Dark Shadows. Burnt Offerings came out in 1976. Of course, also stars Karen Black, Oliver Reed, Eileen Heckert, Betty Davis, Burgess Meredith. Great, great cast. Burnt Offerings is a movie, if you've never seen it, you should definitely watch. So Lee Montgomery is in that. And he's also was known for a movie he made, or for a theatrical film he made also in 1985, the same year The Midnight Hour came out, called Girls Just Want to Have Fun, in which he played Sarah Jessica Parker's dance partner and has a really notable scene in that. And I think that's kind of funny because, as I mentioned, the slogan for The Midnight Hour was "Ghouls Just Want to Have Fun." I don't know if that was an intentional pun. Probably not. Soon after The Midnight Hour, Lee Montgomery actually stopped acting. He pursued other interests. He had worked on soundtracks, but completely kind of dropped off the face of the earth for about 20 years, got a just regular job working at a marketing firm. But he did reappear in a interview in the special feature DVD release of Burnt Offerings in 2015. So shame he's not acting anymore, but he seems to have a very, very happy life, and he is just absolutely perfect as our hero, Phil Grenville. You can't help but love him. Now you have also Sherry Belafonte as Melissa Cavender, the descendant of the witch Lucinda Cavender. In the Midnight Hour credits, she's credited as Sherry Belafonte Harper, but now has just goes by Sherry Belafonte. She is, of course, the daughter of singer and actor Harry Belafonte, and likely Montgomery did some work as a model before she moved into acting. And Midnight Hour, when she made this, she was actually in her early 30s and is playing a teenager. You'd never think that she was in her early 30s watching this movie. But yeah, and did more TV roles after this, was a regular on ABC drama series called Hotel. And she is the one who also lends her vocal talents to Get Dead, the Thriller ripoff number that you are definitely going to enjoy. She's continued to do some voice work as an actor, including on Hey Arnold and Gravedale High, another very, very underrated show. And was recently on the morning show starring Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. Then we have Peter DeLuise as Mitch, who is sort of the hunky jock archetype of the high school friend group. And Peter DeLuise first came to prominence on the television series 21 Jump Street, which was also where Johnny Depp got his big break. But in later years, Peter DeLuise shifted into directing and screenwriting on particular science fiction TV shows, including several iterations of the Stargate franchise. But he also did make a brief cameo appearance along with Johnny Depp in the 2012 film adaptation of 21 Jump Street. Also appearing in this movie, and perhaps definitely the most recognizable actor in this film, is none other than LeVar Burton, who of course got his big break in 1975 playing the role of Kunta Kinte in the original miniseries of Alex Haley's novel Roots. And 2 years before he made The Midnight Hour, 1983, started hosting the PBS kid show Reading Rainbow, which was a favorite of mine and many, many others during the time it was on. And then after Midnight Hour, of course, would also go on to play the role of Geordi LaForge in Star Trek The Next Generation and several films that were made based on that franchise. And, you know, it makes me wonder, like, what PBS might have thought of LeVar Burton being in this sort of bloody vampire witch zombie movie. They probably didn't care. I feel like nowadays the network would be like, oh, you can't do that, you're in this kid's show. But, you know, back in 1985, I don't think it was as big a deal. Also, in our teenage friend group, we have Dee Dee Pfeiffer as Mary, and she is actually the younger sister of Michelle Pfeiffer, who you might have heard of her before. Dee Dee Pfeiffer has also done several other horror movies, including Vamp in 1986 and House 3, The Horror Show in 1989. She was a regular on the CBS sitcom Sybil in the mid to late 1990s, and as recently as 2020, started playing a role in the ABC crime drama series Big Sky. Dee Dee Pfeiffer actually took a break from acting for a period of about 10 years from 2010 to 2020, overcoming alcohol addiction. But also during that time, she earned her master's degree in social work and actually worked as a social worker, and then returned to acting in 2020 in Big Sky. She's wonderful as Mary. We have, so that's our, those are our five teens, Phil, Melissa, Mitch, Vinny, and Mary. Now, on to some of the other characters, some of which are alive, some of which are not. You have Jonna Lee as Sandy Matthews. Sandy is the good ghost of a 50s cheerleader who becomes Phil's love interest throughout the movie. She has had an extensive career primarily in television, but she has retired from acting since, lives in Burbank, and has now become known as an artist primarily working in sculpture as well. She is beautiful in this movie and very, very touching as Sandy. We also have, as the leader of the undead, Janelle Allen, as Lucinda Cavender, who was burned as a witch back in the 1600s, set a curse on the town, which now comes to fruition in 1985. And when she rises from the dead, she's also a vampire now, too, for some reason. It's great. Doesn't matter. Janelle Allen hasn't done a lot in film. She's mostly a theater actor, and got was nominated for the Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical in 1972 for her role in The Two Gentlemen of Verona, a musicalized version of the play by William Shakespeare. And for some reason hasn't appeared on Broadway since, even though she was obviously highly acclaimed in that role. She was active in TV work in the 1980s, 1990s. A lot of people might remember Janelle Allen for playing the role of Grace, the cafe owner in the show Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, starring Jane Seymour. My grandparents loved that show, so I ended up watching a lot of it when I was growing up. Played that role for all seven seasons of the show. But after that, she's primarily worked in theater, also working in a lot of new play development organizations, which is wonderful. And most recently, though, has started voice acting in the podcast soap opera Forever and a Day. She started doing that in 2020 and has a recurring character and has since become a main character in the show. Good for her. We have Cindy Morgan as Vicki Jensen, the sort of hot substitute teacher at the high school. Cindy Morgan is most known for playing Lacey Underall in Caddyshack, but she also plays a dual role in the movie Tron, a movie that many people love, a lot of people hate. I'm ambivalent on Tron. So she was very recognizable in 1985, Cindy Morgan was, you know, primarily due to Caddyshack. We also, probably the second most well-known actor in this movie for people today is Kurtwood Smith as Captain Jensen, the sort of surly, grumpy head of the police force in Pitchford Cove. And of course, Kurtwood Smith is very well known today for playing Red Foreman, the cranky father, in That 70s Show and reprising that role in That 90s Show, which is on now. Kurtwood Smith has had a really amazing career working primarily in television, but he's done some film as well. But almost always playing this sort of like mean, dry, sarcastic dude. He just does it so well. And was actually also played a police officer of a similar type in Deadly Messages, the movie that the writer and director of The Midnight Hour had made earlier the same year, and sort of pilot pitched him over into The Midnight Hour too. And he's great. We also have Dick Van Patten as Dr. Martin Grenville, Phil Grenville's dentist father. Dick Van Patten has a million TV credits, mostly known for his leading role in the show Eight Is Enough, but was in several Mel Brooks movies. He was in Robin Hood, Men in Tights. He was in Spaceballs. He's one of those actors that you have seen in a million different things, even if you didn't necessarily know it was him. And he is in this movie. He's not in it a lot, but there's a very memorable image of Dick Van Patten as Phil's dentist dad that you won't forget. You'll know it when you see it. We also, as Phil's mother, Janet Grenville, Sheila Larkin, who is, again, not in this movie a lot, but you might recognize her, especially if you're a horror fan, because she played Dana Scully's mother, Margaret, in The X-Files, which I'm sure you all have seen. We also have another very recognizable face in this cast is Kevin McCarthy, who plays Judge Crandall, who's Mitch's mean alcoholic father, and he does a great job. Kevin McCarthy first came to prominence in the film version of Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, playing Biff Loman, and received a nomination for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for that work. Kevin McCarthy is most well known, though, for playing the lead in the iconic and classic science fiction film Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which was released in 1956. He also made a cameo in the 1970s remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers as well. Kevin McCarthy, again, has a million TV, film, and theater credits to his name, and he is absolutely hateful as Judge Crandall, and meets a very, very terrifying demise and then becomes undead himself. We also have Wolfman Jack as the radio DJ. And Wolfman Jack, especially for folks of an earlier generation, like, and everyone will recognize his voice. He appears in set, he hosted many radio shows during his career, and just had an iconic raspy voice. And he said that, you know, the way he could use his voice is why he became successful. There's a fun quote from him where he said about his voice, "It's kept meat and potatoes on the table for years for Wolfman and Wolfwoman. A couple of shots of whiskey helps it. I've got that nice raspy sound." And very, very sadly, Wolfman Jack, whose real name was Robert Weston Smith, died very prematurely on July 1st, 1995, of a heart attack. He was only 57 years old, but he does his Wolfman Jack thing as the radio announcer and DJ during the midnight hours all throughout the film. And really, the movie would not be the same without him. He really makes an indelible contribution to this movie, I think. And a few other cast members that are worthy of note. We have Mark Blankfield, who is credited in the opening credits as the ghoul. He gets a very special, like, and Mark Blankfield as the ghoul. And again, does a really incredible comedic performance in some amazing makeup. And you also have Mickey Morton, who plays Vernon Nestor, who is the town's resident's, you know, nightmarish serial killer who has been tried, executed, and is now buried in the cemetery, but not for long. Mickey Morton was 6'7" tall, so he is a quite horrifying presence in this movie. He is also has a very famous bit of trivia about him, in that Mickey Morton was the first actor ever to appear in both the Star Trek and the Star Wars universes. Mickey Morton appeared in an episode of the third season of the original Star Trek in 1968. 10 years later, Mickey Morton, again, 6'7", got him a lot of work, plays a Wookiee in the infamous Star Wars Holiday Special, which George Lucas has tried to basically wipe away from existence because it is absolutely bonkers, ridiculous, and not good. And finally, making his very first appearance on film in an uncredited role as a trick-or-treater is none other than Macaulay Culkin. So you see, there's a lot of really great, you know, actors in this film, and, you know, great writing, a director who went on to become one of the most respected and acclaimed television directors currently working now. But in 1985, they all made this horror comedy love letter to Halloween that aired on Friday, November 1st of 1985. I do love that at the bottom of the original like poster used to advertise this film probably was in TV Guide at the time. At the bottom of it, it says, "Caution, Halloween didn't end last night." And that is the spirit we are going into this episode with, my friends. We're going to watch The Midnight Hour again. It is on YouTube. You can watch it in its pristine, you know, DVD state. It runs for 94 minutes. Or, if you choose, you can watch it on YouTube with the original 1985 television commercials, making it just under 2 hours. I will say that with my timestamps, again, I am using the version without commercials, but my breaks come pretty much when the commercial breaks come, so you should be able to figure it out. So we are going to get started. I hope you've got your popcorn ready. Turn out the lights and get ready for a spooky good time. Now, we're going to watch the beginning of the movie, and you're going to stop the movie once you've reached 25 minutes and 53 seconds. I'll see you all again in 25 minutes, 53 seconds. Enjoy. Like I said, I love the opening credits to The Midnight Hour. Again, they just do such a perfect job of setting up this movie and the town, which is very important for what happens later. You know, you sort of get this just quintessential, cozy Americana in autumn with like the leaves turning, you know, everyone, you know, smiling, happy to be there. And you see the milkman, like all these different business people. You see an old lady knitting on a bench in the town square with a gazebo, and two little girls playing in the leaves. Love that the bicycle shop has a mannequin on it that is dressed to look like the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz on a bicycle. And of course, the kid at the very beginning who is delivering the paper route, which is the means by which we are introduced to this town, which is a very, very very smart and economical screenwriting and directing, I think. It's such a perfect way to bring you into the world of the film. And I love that the little kid, paperboy kid, God, that's a profession that doesn't exist anymore, but he puts, you know, a skull mask over his head, and he, for Halloween time, and is clipping a baseball card to his bicycle to make it snap, which again, I don't think people do anymore either. But then like cuts his finger and gets blood on some of the newspapers, which is a really fun way to begin the film. Many years ago, there was a version of the film that was put on YouTube that has since been taken down and replaced with others. But the actor who played that paperboy wearing the skull mask in the opening credits of The Midnight Hour actually commented on the movie and was like, "Hey, that was me. I had such a fun time making this film. It's so great to see it again." It's a shame that version was taken down, because I would have loved to have been able to try and find him and talk to him. But lovely, lovely beginning to The Midnight Hour. And having watched this movie as many times as I have, which is a lot, the opening credits also kind of take on another sort of darker sense to me, because, you know, with what all the people you see in this idyllic opening images of this New England town established back in 1677, Pitchford Cove, considering what is going to happen later in this film, where basically the entire town is, you know, everyone is killed and turned into these undead zombies and vampires and werewolves and such, I always think about the people who were in the opening credits of this movie. Like, what happened to that old lady sitting in the park? What happened to those little girls playing in the leaves? Like, were they killed too? And I almost, in my mind, I kind of created this like scene for myself that I imagine is in a later portion of the movie where, like, when all hell literally breaks loose, like, you know, and everything is going crazy outside in the town, that you just see, like, these little kids, like, hiding under their beds, you know, as all this terror is happening around them. Because I'm like, what happened to them? But yeah, I may just perfect opening credits, establishing the Halloween atmosphere exactly as you'd want. And then eventually we get to the high school with, again, all these actors who are definitely not actually teenagers. They are mid-20s, and that's being generous. Yeah, it's great. I mean, that's a thing with all, I think, really any movie in the 1980s that featured teenagers, the actors are all, like, 30. as Sherry Belafonte literally was, but she, you know, she doesn't look it. And you have Phil Grenville, who gives his historic presentation about Halloween and gives us the lore of the town, that Phil's ancestor, Nathaniel Grenville, was the constable general, and the enslaved women who worked for him, Lucinda Cavender, was, as Phil says, one of the most powerful witches that ever lived, and notes that Lucinda is also the ancestor of Phil's friend, also a student in the classroom, Melissa Cavender. And you see, when I watch this scene now, I see it differently, or, you know, receive it differently than I did when I watched the movie growing up. Like, as Phil, who's this white dude, is talking about this, you see Melissa just kind of slink down in her seat, sort of like, oh God, no, why is he doing that? And Phil actually calls her out and's like, it was, you know, the ancestor of Melissa. And she cuts him off, says, I know, we all know. It was that old black magic. You know, like, it comes across as kind of not mean-spirited, but I guess in a little callous and insensitive to call her out like that. But you need it for the setup. So we learn from the lore that Phil presents that Lucinda Cavender released a terrible curse on the town on Halloween, because in the world of this movie, Halloween is the day when witchcraft is most powerful. Which, yeah, maybe that's true. I don't know. You know, and in this curse, as he puts it, all the legendary demons of hell were loosed, and all those who had unfinished business rose from their graves. And although he says no one knows how he did it, Nathaniel Grenville, the witch hunter general, ended the curse at midnight on Halloween. And then the next day, Lucinda Cavender was hanged in the town square. And again, you see Melissa, Lucinda's ancestor, being very, very uncomfortable about that. We also learn that the little town of Pitchford, a.k.a. Pitchfork Cove, has its own witchcraft museum, because that's probably the only notable thing that ever occurred in this town, was, you know, this spooky Halloween curse and witch hanging. But in their museum, they have wax figurines of Nathaniel Grenville and Lucinda Cavender that are actually wearing Nathaniel and Lucinda's clothes that have been handed down through the generations. And that gives Mitch an idea. There, because Melissa's having a big Halloween party at the Cavender Mansion tonight, they decide to go break into the museum and steal the costumes. Melissa will wear Lucinda's her ancestor's old clothes. Phil doesn't want to wear Nathaniel's old clothes, so Mitch takes them, because Mitch is the big buff jock and the clothes will actually fit him. But they also go down to they go into the basement and they find a trunk that belonged to Nathaniel Grenville that has a scroll in it. And they take the trunk and decide, oh, where are we going to put on these costumes? I know. Let's go to the cemetery like you do. And I have to say, I think The cemetery in the midnight hour is one of the great graveyards in horror history. Just aesthetically. Like, it is big, it's got these hills, there's leaves on the ground, there's all these creepy tombs, and because the gravedigger has been, like, burning piles of leaves, there's sort of this smoke and fog everywhere. It's just genuinely creepy graveyard that's going to get a lot creepier. And they also introduce Vernon Nestor pass by his gravestone, which someone has spray painted on it in red spray paint, killer monster, and setting him up as, like, he was this fearsome, very tall, psychotic killer. And they break the seal on the scroll, and Phil's like, oh, you shouldn't read this. And Melissa's like, I'm going to read it. It's in my blood. And she reads the incantation, her ancestor Lucinda's curse from the 17th century, releasing all the demons of hell and all those who had unfinished business from their graves on Halloween night. And then she pretends to faint, and then they're all like, wait a second, we just learned about this in prison in school today. And Phil's literally like, didn't anyone pay attention to what I talked about in class? And they're all like, no. Which is so high school. That's a very honest moment, I think. And then they're like, maybe we should get out of here. And what follows that sequence where literally all hell breaks loose and all the graves start exploding and all the dead start coming out of the graves. Honestly, I don't care that this is a TV movie. That sequence where the dead rise from the graveyard is, I think, one of the most impressive and one of the scariest sequences I've ever seen in a horror film. Like, and I think it's notable for its variety too. Like, it's not just that you have zombies rising from the grave. Like, you get to see them clawing. Like, you see people from all, you know, the dead from all different periods of time rising up. You see the werewolf coming up, you see a little dwarf zombie werewolf person. You see the famous ghoul that you'll be seeing a lot of, Lucinda Cavender. I love the image of her, you know, wiping away the cobwebs from her face with her hands after she rises. It's really impressive for a TV movie. Like, it, that this scene looks expensive. I don't think you'd see a scene this elaborate in a TV movie today. And, you know, then you also meet Sandy, who is the only person who emerges from the grave looking like a normal person, looking as she must have done when she died in the 1950s, buried in her high school cheerleader uniform. And everyone starts making their way to the town to kill and wreak havoc. This is one of those scenes that I hid behind the sofa when I was watching it as a kid, and honestly, like, it still creeps me out. And again, I think the music used in this scene is excellent at conveying the really eerie and creepy mood of it. If I was to show anyone one scene from The Midnight Hour to convince them to watch it, it would be this scene in the graveyard. The second one would be the Get Dead musical number. And really, those two scenes sell the movie. Like, those two scenes are the two different extremes of The Midnight Hour. And again, this is one of those rare horror comedies that gets both extremes really, really right. So good. So many people are about to die. So we're going to get back to the movie, friends. We're going to pause the movie when you get to 36 minutes and 8 seconds. See you again at 36 minutes and 8 seconds, my friends. Enjoy. Okay, we have to talk about Phil's Halloween costume, okay? So Phil Grenville has been set up to be sort of, again, like the nerdy kid of the high school group, but his Halloween costume, as he reveals it to his family, he's clearly very proud of and should be. He is a vampire with a silver, like, Christmas tinsel wig, this very well done vampire makeup, still wearing his glasses though, classic vampire suit, you know, huge cape with this like purple satin lining, and Converse sneakers, of course, you know, and he opens the cape and his family, he tells his family, open their eyes, and his sister says, bodacious. And he's like, all right, which is, he's so pleased with himself, as he should be. And I love the sister's, what she says in reaction to it is so 80s. Love it. Love this costume choice. And it's a really lovely character moment, I think, too, because, you know, again, this person who is obviously very shy, is not comfortable in social situations, you know, has a crush on Mary, but, like, you know, she doesn't really pay attention, you know, so, you know, but on Halloween, this is the night where Phil can really, you know, express himself and be comfortable and, like, give his historic presentation in class about Halloween and witches' curses and stuff, and then dress up in one of the most awesome Halloween costumes of anyone in town. We love that for Phil. It's a shame it's all about to go wrong. And you also, after this scene, get one of the first great uses of a 50s song with the Little Red Riding Hood song that is used as Phil gets into his car, and Phil's car is also vintage 1950s as well, the sort of powder blue car, you know, which I think is, again, very smart screenwriting, because both the music that surrounds Phil and his car makes him a perfect match for Sandy, the undead cheerleader looking for love. And after that, you get a glimpse into the home life of Mitch, you know, who, again, is like the sort of hunky jock dude. And I love this scene because you get a glimpse of his home life, where his father, Judge Crandall, is this like horrifically mean and abusive alcoholic, who's like, I know you stole those clothes. If you get caught, I'm gonna get you. I'm gonna get you good. And Mitch runs off, and you also see poor Mitch's mother, who doesn't say a word, is sort of sitting quietly doing her needlepoint, like, just, and again, like, makes you wonder, like, God, what must she be thinking? Like, what is her life like? Then you have their first meeting of Phil and Sandy, and Phil first sees Sandy, and then there's this really cute and delightful fantasy sequence from his point of view, that happens in his mind, where, like, she's in front of, like, a train stop or whatever, and he's like, sitting on the hood of his car in his costume, all sexy with his cape all around him, and then is jarred back to reality when she actually speaks to him. Lovely little moment. And again, like, it's so, that is so something Phil, I think, would envision, you know, something that could happen. And then Sandy actually speaks to him, and they, you know, start developing a rapport. Like, the two, it's such a sweet little romance that happens between them in this movie. It adds such a lovely dimension to the Midnight Hour, the Phil Sandy love story. I think it's the heart of the movie, I think. Absolutely the heart of it. And the movie would not be nearly as good as it is without that storyline and the performances of Lee Montgomery and Jonna Lee as Phil and Sandy. They make it absolutely believable, like, you, and sweet. Like, you want this couple to succeed and get together. But then, contrasted with that moment of, like, sweet teenage romance, very soon afterward, you get a really, really horrifying scene, and again is another one of the scenes that I would hide behind the couch when it happened and still kind of unsettles me today, where, you know, Judge Crandall, Mitch's you know, mean alcoholic father goes outside to take out the garbage and is confronted by, you know, psychotic serial killer Vernon Nestor, now undead. Judge Crandall's the one who sentenced Vernon Nestor to death, and now Vernon Nestor has come straight from the graveyard to kill the man who caused him to be executed. And it really is so well directed and performed that you see Vernon Nestor lurking outside of the house through the glass windows. And then when Judge Crandall goes to take out the trash, like, hears something moving around, and he thinks it's kids that are trying to prank him, and then, like, the garbage cans just, like, explode, and Vernon Nestor is there and looks down at Judge Crandall and says, "Guilty," and then strangles him to death. Super, super scary. And then again, a shot I love that after Vernon Nestor walks away, the camera then goes to a shot of looking at Mrs. Crandall, you know, doing her knitting. And again, it's one of the characters you wonder, like, what happened to her after this? We never see her again. Ooh. All right, let's get back to the movie, my friends. We are going to watch until we are 50 minutes into the film. See ya when we're at 50 minutes. So we finally get to see Melissa Cavender's Halloween party in full swing at the old Cavender Mansion, which is also that house, if it looks familiar to you, is also used as a filming location in Scream 2 as well. And of really great costumes from the guests at this party, including a couple people dressed up as characters from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which, you know, I saw this first when I was 8, so I was a couple years away from seeing Rocky Horror for the first time. But when I didn't rewatch Midnight Hour again, I was like, oh my god, it's Magenta! And stuff like that. Also at this party, they have a coffin that is filled with popcorn, which is such a brilliant idea, and I'm gonna steal that for next year's Halloween party. That I love it. And also, you have the undead begin to make their way to the party, starting with the ghoul, who LeVar Burton is like, wow, that is a sick costume and the voice, wow. Because LeVar Burton's character, as we saw, put in very minimal effort in his Halloween costume, just wrapped some toilet paper around himself and covered himself with some ketchup and egg to be a sort of half-assed mummy. And also arriving at the party is Lucinda Cavender, Melissa's ancestor, the witch, who is now also a vampire, as we will soon see. And it's actually kind of a brilliant device because no one notices when all the, you know, undead ghouls and zombies and such come to the Halloween party because everyone's in costume already anyway, which is really fun to watch as the movie goes on, as more and more members of the party are slowly turned to the dark side. We have the little dwarf werewolf zombie, whatever it's supposed to be, that people take note of. And again, the sort of ghoul or the drunk zombie, as I often call him, who discovers popcorn and says to him, "Popcorn, good." Just really, really fun performance. And Phil says very prophetically, "This is gonna be a weird night." And also, of course, the substitute teacher, Vicky, is also at the party, ostensibly as a chaperone as well. And she has come with her boyfriend, who is dressed up as Death. To which Mitch says, "I'm not afraid of Death," which will come back to haunt him later. And then we come to the third scene in this movie that caused me to hide behind the sofa in the living room when I was a kid, and that I still find very unnerving, is when Lester, the tobacco-chewing redneck in a New England town, weird, but that's what he is, who is sort of the guard of the town, I guess. It's unclear, but whatever. He walks around chewing tobacco with his dogs. He's walking through the streets of the town at night, hears a howling noise, and his dogs decide, nope, we're out, and his dogs run away, which I'm very glad. I hope the dogs made it safely through this Halloween night. But then Lester says another prophetic line, what the devil's going on here? And then notices that there's some noise coming from the local barber shop where the demon werewolf that we saw come out of the cemetery is lurking, jumps through the window, jumps onto Lester and begins biting and just absolutely mauling him as if he's a chew toy. Again, I think one of the few instances where a werewolf is actually frightening, because it's depicted as just this vicious, vicious killing machine that you don't see its face a lot. And it's, again, I think a really great directorial choice by Jack Bender, that as Lester's being mauled to a bloody pulp by the werewolf, the camera just sort of is on a crane that like retreats up and up and up, so that you're looking at it almost from a bird's eye view. Like, no one is going to help these people. No one is going to stop the evil that is taking over the town. Great, great scene. Then we have a really, after that, we have a really lovely scene again back at the party. Where, you know, poor Phil is being ignored by Mary, who's interested in a very hot dude who's dressed as Frankenstein, kind of, says she wants to be her costume to be the bride of Frankenstein. Then there's a really nice scene between Mary and Melissa in the upstairs bathroom where they're talking about, like, their various, like, boy troubles, and it's a really lovely scene, and one of the scenes where, like, they actually seem like they're actually talking and acting like they are teenage high school students, and it's just really lovely work, and you see the friendship between both of them. But then Lucinda is suddenly there, and I have to, you know, take a moment to really single out Jonelle Allen for her wonderful work as Lucinda in this film. She, as a vampire witch, really sells the part, because she just has this quality of immense stillness and also intensity that is really captivating and eerie. In the scene when she's alone with Melissa for the first time, Nass, like, that's a very pretty dress. Where did you get it? And Melissa said, oh, it's been in my family for years. She said, I once had a dress very much like that a long time ago. And again, I think it's another piece of really wonderful directing by Jack Bender, where Melissa's combing her hair to the side, exposing her throat. And you see the camera just goes on these more and more tight shots on Lucinda's face, her eye, and then her lips parting as she's about to bite Melissa. But then Mary comes back in, so Melissa is safe for a little while anyway. And then we're back, and Lester's two dogs have returned to him on the ground after he's been killed by the werewolf, and the dogs, of course, as any dogs would do, start eating the dog treats that are in Lester's pockets, even though their owner is now dead. But he seemed like a nasty guy anyway. But then there's a howling, and we notice, hey, aren't Lester's fingernails really long and sharp now? And then Lester stands up, and he is a werewolf, killed by a werewolf. He has now become a werewolf himself. The first instance in the movie where We see the second part of Lucinda's curse come to fruition. He who is touched by evil will become evil. And it's a small touch, but one of the a moment I really love is when Werewolf Lester, who wears glasses, then takes off his glasses and flings them off like, I have no use for these things now. And then we go to the wine cellar where Melissa has gone to get some more wine for the chaperones, including the substitute teacher. And of course, Lucinda comes down there with her. And what follows, I think, is one of this movie's most iconic scenes visually. Melissa's trying to find wine, and she asks Lucinda, what should I use, red or white? And Lucinda says, red, definitely red. And then you see her swing back her cape like a vampire bat, and in slow motion lunges toward Lucinda as this amazing music plays in the background. Lucinda bites Melissa, her descendant. And because this is a made-for-TV film, there's really not a lot of blood in this movie. Almost none, except for very, very small instances. So, again, I think this is a brilliant choice by the director to work around the restrictions of what they could show on television, in that even though it makes no sense whatsoever, it doesn't matter. But then as Melissa is being attacked by Lucinda, wine bottles start flying off of the shelves of the wine cellar that they're in. And it's all red wine. They break on the floor. They pop open. So as Melissa's being attacked by Lucinda, you just see these streams of red wine flying all across the room and pooling on the floor as if it is like blood. Again, logically, doesn't make a damn bit of sense. But does it make a visual impact. It's kind of uncanny, and is a really, I think, smart and very effective way of showing, and again, it's all in slow motion too, which I think is a big part of it, of showing the act of the blood being drained from the body. And there's an interesting element of sensuality to Lucinda biting Melissa as well. And of course, they're family, so there's a bit of an incestuous element there too. But it is a really, really amazing scene. One of the scenes which like will stick in your mind once you've seen this film. Oh, so good. All right, my friends, we're going to get back to the movie. We're going to watch until the movie reaches 1 hour, 5 minutes, and 47 seconds. 1 hour, 5 minutes, 47 seconds. See you then, my friends. All right, so Lucinda, after feeding on Melissa, returns upstairs to the party. And her skin is now a ghostly white. Again, that probably wouldn't go well today. black actors basically putting in whiteface. But it works visually. It tells the story that now the vampire has fed. And is rejuvenated. But again, why does that make them white? I don't know. But it looks good. And Janelle Allen looks absolutely gorgeous. No matter what. And at the party, Phil has gotten frustrated because Mitch is dancing with Vicky Jensen, the substitute teacher. The drunk zombie ghoul has found another undead ghoul woman, and they're passionately making out on the sofa. And Phil's finally like, okay, I'm out of here. This party's not working for me. I'm leaving. Which turns out to be a very good decision for Phil. And then we come back to Sandy, who goes back to her old house and discovers her house is not there anymore and is very confused at why things are different now. Perhaps is realizing for the first time that she is actually dead and that much time has, decades have passed since she died. But she and Phil meet up again, and again, this lovely little romance starts to bloom between them. Back at the party, Melissa comes back up from the wine cellar, now also a vampire with much lighter skin, and finally starts showing some attention to Vinny, played by LeVar Burton, and bites him in the very middle of the party, and you see fang marks in his neck. One of the few instances of blood you see in the midnight hour. I also love when Phil and Sandy are... go to the movie theater. They're standing outside the marquee, which is having a Halloween fright night. The first movie on the bill is Deadly Message, which is the title of the movie that the director Jack Bender and screenwriter William Blake made earlier this year. The script was nominated for an Edgar Award. Nice little Easter egg in there. And Sandy suggests that maybe they go parking, even though parking's not something that they do anymore in 1985. Phil listens to her when she suggests they go to the lake, which is nice and isolated, and they're making out. They suggest that they get, she takes off his glasses, she suggests they get in the back seat, and Phil's finally going to lose his virginity, but then Werewolf Lester attacks them. Really excellent scene, you know, because it's set up with, you know, because Phil has this 50s convertible that has this top that can go up and down, but it being period is cloth, so the werewolf is able to claw through it. Really great, really fun and suspenseful fight scene. They finally manage to flip Vampire Lester off the bridge. They escape. You think, oh, the werewolf has drowned. You see the rippling water and the quiet for a long moment. And then great kind of jump scare, sting of music as Werewolf Lester sort of explodes out of the water. And he is ready to kill some more people. Really lovely scene. All right, so more and more members of the party are getting turned to the undead, and we're going to continue watching the movie. We're going to come back when we've reached 1 hour, 14 minutes, and 16 seconds. 1 hour, 14 minutes, and 16 seconds. See you then, my friends. You know, it's a full moon on Halloween that brings out the crazy, says one of the policemen. So we're at the point in any good horror, any respectable horror movie like this, where, you know, Phil and Sandy, our heroes and heroine of this film, have gone to the police now, you know, with what's going on. And we learn that there have been many other reports throughout Pitchford Cove of people experiencing werewolf attacks and vampire attacks, including one old woman who swore she saw her husband turn into a bat and fly out the window. And of course, the cops don't believe any of it. Kurtwood Smith as Captain Jensen, you know, again says, "Halloween, my favorite time of the year." And they report that the corpse of Vernon Nestor is missing. And he says, "I'll probably find him propped up on my front lawn tomorrow." So, of course, the cops do not believe Phil and Sandy's story. Sandy calls them the Fuzz. And Jensen says, "Fuzz, haven't heard that in a while." Another clue that Sandy is not just dressed like a cheerleader from the 50s, she actually is from the 50s. Now, after they leave the police station, Sandy tells Phil that she knows what is going on, that the ritual that they performed at the graveyard did work, and the dead are walking in Pitchford Cove on this Halloween night. And she says that some of the dead, not all of them, are out to kill. And Phil says, what do you mean not all of them? And Sandy says, some of them might just want to fall in love. Because Sandy never got to fall in love before she died. It's a really sweet moment. And Phil eventually doesn't quite believe Sandy, but then we see Judge Crandall crash into the car. Judge Crandall is now an undead zombie like Vernon Nestor is. And after that, Phil becomes a believer. And from this point on, Phil and Sandy are on a mission to try and end the Halloween curse before midnight, just like Nathaniel Grenville did all those centuries ago, or else the curse will become permanent. And then we come to the scene that I think it most people know the Midnight Hour exists because of this one scene. And I am talking about Get Dead, the Thriller ripoff, full-on musical number that is in this movie that was choreographed by some of the same choreographers that worked on Thriller. And Get Dead is, it's a genuinely good and catchy song. It should be added to all of your Halloween party playlists for next year. Has really fun and goofy choreography to it. And the vocals are done by Sherry Belafonte, who plays Melissa, with an intro by Wolfman Jack. And it's a really fun scene, but it also serves a very smart narrative purpose. Again, very economical in its writing and directing, because not only is it a fun musical number that everyone at the party eventually gets involved in, but it's during the course of the musical number where you see the remaining alive people at the party. Everyone slowly gets turned into the undead. So that the next time we're back at the party, there isn't anyone left who is still among the living. Everyone has been turned evil. So good. And again, I think if people know of the Midnight Hour at all, they know it because of Get Dead, the Thriller ripoff musical number, which is absolutely fabulous. All right, my friends, we are now going to watch until the very end of the film, and we'll catch up afterward. Enjoy the horrifying conclusion of the Midnight Hour. Okay, so immediately after the thrilling performance of Get Dead by Melissa Cavender and everyone else at the party, we go back to Phil and Sandy, who are in his dad's dentist office melting down silver to make silver bullets so they can kill werewolves, obviously. And very briefly Phil's dad, the dentist, who has been turned into a vampire himself. And there's just a couple shots of vampire dentist dad, where he's holding a drill, and he actually looks quite terrifying, I think. Really, really good imagery. And again, the dad is played by Dick Van Patten, who is sort of known in most of his television roles as being like very nice, like warm and cuddly, you know, dad type. And so to see this image of him as this like wild haired, you know, vampire with fangs and blood dripping down his mouth, with the dentist. There's something about vampire dentists that there's something off-putting about that. Really effective scene. And then we are back at the party where Mitch is one of the few left alive. Melissa tries to seduce him to bite him, but Mitch is distracted by his father's car and doesn't realize that his father is now an undead zombie who's still very, very mean. and starts attacking his son, says, "Nothing to say, dear sweet old dad," and then strangles his own son while laughing maniacally. And great performance by Kevin McCarthy as Judge Crandall, both horrible and terrifying in this movie. And it is at this point in the midnight hour, when there's about 20 minutes left to go, that the movie completely stops being funny. It is, you know, up till now, it's been a mix of funny and scary. Now, from now on, its last 20 minutes, it is full on horror, and done very well. I think one of my favorite scenes, and the final scene of the movie that I would hide behind the living room sofa when it came on growing up, is the scene when Phil and Sandy are driving through the town square, the same idyllic town square that we saw in the opening credits of the movie, but now it has literally been turned into a hell. You know, it's dark and there's fog, there's ghosts everywhere, there's Revolutionary War soldier ghosts, you see the werewolf pawing out the window, the dead walking around, and most haunting of all, there is like a Phantom of the Opera-esque ghost who is singing, an operatic aria in the gazebo, and it just, that the beauty and eeriness of the opera singing mixed with the imagery of all these scary looking like phantoms walking around, I think it's really unsettling. Beautiful too, like beautiful and horrific at the same time. And again, it's such a clever echo of the opening credits. Like the nice little mailman that she saw in the opening credits is now dead and burnt, and like throwing the mail into a burning car, setting it on fire. The nice milkman we saw in the opening credits is standing on top of his truck, just pouring the milk in a slow motion shot. The demon werewolf rips up a fire hydrant. And Phil and Sandy are driving very slowly in their car through all of this, hoping that the ghosts won't notice them. And they finally get back. There's a police car, and Captain Jensen, the police who scoffed at all these reports of vampires and werewolves, are now dead too. Jensen turns toward them and his hand is on fire. And again, really great directed and edited sequence with just these short, in the final moments of it, these shortcuts of all of these horrific images. So good. Really, really frightening sequence. And then we're back to the party. Melissa has turned Mary into a vampire. And there's some really, really great dialogue between Melissa and Lucinda. Like the relationship that they have once Melissa is also a vampire, there's something really great about it. You know, even though they're separated across the centuries, finding the common ground. And like Lucinda says, looking at how Mary's dressed, is like, if a woman dressed like that when I was in my time, she'd be burnt at the stake. And Melissa says, well, sometimes things change. And then we see Mary biting the Frankenstein dude she lusted after earlier in the movie. And Lucinda says, some things never change. And then they continue turning the entire party into vampires and various forms of undead. And it's worth noting that, you know, Melissa in particular, like, her personality changes a lot once she becomes a vampire. And there are moments where it's almost over the top, but not quite. And that's, I think, a really great thing to note about all of the actors in this movie really understood the assignment. The tone of this film, that sort of tightrope walk between true horror and comedy, everyone gets it. No, there is not a single wrong note in any of the performances throughout this entire film. It's really a wonderfully acted, directed, and written movie. Love the scene when Phil and Sandy come back to the Cavender house and they think it's deserted. And it's almost like the film goes into black and white, that the house itself has been drained of all life and color. It's the realm of the dead now. And of course, everyone there is dead. All Phil's old friends are dead. And what they need to do is get Nathaniel Grenville's ring, which happens to be on Mitch's finger. And Mitch is, of course, now a zombie because he was killed by his dad, Judge Crandall. Great moment where they're trying to get the ring and Sandy holds up a meat cleaver and Phil's like, no, and instead pours ketchup on Mitch's hand to be able to get the ring off. And then they got a race to the cemetery as the horde of the undead is following them in the car. They've got to take some of Nathaniel Grenville's bones. Luckily, he didn't have any unfinished business, so he is just a skeleton in a coffin. So they get bones, they mix it with the wax and the dead, which also includes the substitute teacher who they think is not a vamp, who they think is still human at first, but then turns out to be a vampire. And then they manage to kill her. But they get to the car, and again, with the great, great cinematography, great directing of these shots, where just this all every single character in the entire movie now in full zombie vampire undead mode, swarming around the car as they seal the scroll with the curse, put the ring on it, and then nothing happens. And then Sandy says, Phil, I love you. And then she fades away to white. All the undead fade away to white. And everything is as it was before all this all happened. The graveyard is silent. The top of Phil's car is no longer ripped. His costume is no longer ripped. But Sandy's gone. And he goes to her grave in the cemetery, which has his coat on it. Lovely nod to the whole Vanishing Hitchhiker kind of urban legend. Sandy Matthews died in 1959, but he lifts up his coat. And on the gravestone, written in Sandy's lipstick, is SMNPG, Sandy Matthews and Phil Grenville, and then a lipstick kiss. And he takes his finger and puts a little bit of the lipstick and dips in the lipstick, puts a little bit on it on his own. And he says, I love you too, Sandy. And then gets back in the car. Wolfman Jack is on the radio again. It's just past midnight on Halloween. And Wolfman Jack says that you got one more song. This is from Sandy to Phil. Phil stops short and the song Baby I'm Yours starts playing. I'm actually getting a little choked up right now because it's actually such a beautiful end to this film. The song Baby I'm Yours starts playing that Sandy's somehow dedicated to Phil across time. Incidentally, that song is not period appropriate. The song Baby I'm Yours actually came out in 1965, but Sandy died in 1959, so that's a plot hole. But the song is perfect for this moment, so it doesn't... I don't care. And as the song plays, Phil takes a moment to take it all in. Then he starts driving away, and then he makes the top of his convertible retract, which he never did on his own, but he did for Sandy. So this night has marked him. His brief moment of love with Sandy has marked him, and it's I think a lovely end to this film. It's almost like, ooh, went on such a ride, but here's this, we end with this very human and ghost sort of love story, as the credits roll across the moon. And presumably everyone who died in the movie is back alive. We're assuming because the graveyard is pristine. All the undead disappeared. So presumably it's as if the events of set in motion by the curse never happened at all. So I hope you enjoyed watching The Midnight Hour. As I said, I love this movie to pieces. It is the one movie I have to watch every single Halloween. And I hope that it enters your rotation of movies to watch on Halloween. Hope you add Get Dead to your playlist. And yeah, even though it is November 1st, as the advertisement for the original airing of The Midnight Hour said, Halloween didn't end last night. And just because October has ended doesn't mean Halloween can't still live on in all of our hearts. Every day can be Halloween if you really want it to be. Trust me, my friends. So, that is my Halloween treat for all of you. Thank you for listening. And next up on the Hitchens on Horror podcast, coming up later this week, will be the final episode into our deep dive of the Friday the 13th franchise of the 80s. Next, we'll be talking about and watching Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. A movie that is very divisive. Some people give it a lot of hate. I think it's kind of undeserved. I think there is a lot done right in Jason Takes Manhattan, and in a lot of ways brings the franchise full circle back to the beginning. So that is what we'll be watching together next. Until then, my friends, happy Halloween. Good night.